Hey y'all, and welcome back to another episode of True Crime Boulevard. I'm your host Bree, and this week we're gonna be talking about Edmund Kemper. Okay, so y'all, I know it's been a while, but I'm back now. Ooh, words. I'm back, and I'm trying to be a little more consistent this year, making sure I get these episodes out. So yeah, I'm so sorry that I've been gone. I'm also working on a new podcast, so keep your eyes out for that. So with all that information out of the way, let's go ahead and jump into this. So trigger warning. This whole episode is a trigger warning. I think I put some extra trigger warnings in here, but like just know that the whole episode from start to finish, the whole episode is a trigger warning. So we're gonna be talking about animal abuse, torture, shooting, stabbing, strangulation, decapitation, defiling a corpse, dismemberment, irrematio, all kinds of things, okay, guys? So yeah, it's just all the things in here. If any of these things are too much for you right now, please take care of yourself and your mental health, and I hope you'll be able to join us in a future episode. So in my usual fashion, all of this good information will be in the show notes down below. Any websites that I used, any podcasts that I listened to, any videos that I watched, because I did watch a lot of like documentaries about this. I also listened to a lot of podcast episodes. So all that information will be in the show notes for you guys. So if you would like to, listen to those or read any of that for yourself, it'll be there. So yeah, let's go ahead and get this thing started. So we're going to talk about his early life a little bit, where he came from. So he was born Edmund Emil Kemper III. He was born December 18th, 1948, in Burbank, California, to Clarnell Stage and Edmund Emil Kemper Jr. He was the only boy of his parents' three children. His parents divorced in 1957. His father would go on to move and get married again and have a stepchild, and they lived in California. Kemper would go on to move in with his mom and his two sisters, and they would move to Montana. But his relationship with his mom would, continue to deteriorate. He had a lot of issues with his mom, he said, because she drank a lot, and this caused a lot of problems with their relationship. And he said that the issues between him and his mom is why he would go on to do what he later did. He said his mom would make fun of him, call him names, and she became very violent towards him. She would make him sleep in a locked basement because she was fearful that he would like molest his sisters or do something to them if he were to sleep upstairs with the rest of the family. Which, I mean, hindsight being 2020, was she wrong? I don't know. Possibly. Her actions might have, assisted in his madness. Who knows? It's also believed that his mother dealt with borderline personality disorder, but Kemper also had a pretty dark side himself. He would dream about killing his mother. He would cut off the heads of his sister's dolls. He liked to play this game called Gas Chamber, where he would have his sisters blindfold him, lead him to a chair, and then once he was in the chair, he would pretend that he was in agony until he quote unquote died. So that was like a game they would play when he was 10 years old. First trigger warning, he buried the family cat alive, and then he unburied it, dismembered the cat, and then put the cat's head on a stake. He did this at 10. At 13, he slaughtered the family cat, the second family cat. He slaughtered it, and he said he took a lot of pleasure, like he enjoyed that a lot, because he lied about it. Like, he lied about doing it. He's like, "No, I didn't do anything. What are you talking about?" And he knew how much his sister loved that cat, and he took great pleasure out of like causing everybody else pain and like lying about it. Now, Kemper managed to keep a pretty good relationship with his father, but the divorce between his parents strained his relationship with his dad a little bit, and it was really, really hard on him on Kemper himself. Like, he took it especially hard. And then for him, the relationship between him and his mom was like complete hell. And the fact that he was living with his mom, he was like, "What the fuck?" His father said at one point, living with Clarnell, his mom, was like living a suicide mission in war times, and the atomic bomb testings were nothing compared to living with her. Like, he was like, it was actual hell. So By the time Kemper was 14, he ran away from his mom. He ran to Van Nuys, California, where he stayed with his dad. But when he got there, he learned that his dad had gotten remarried and they had a stepson, which made him very unhappy. So he stayed with his dad for a little bit. But after a while, his dad ended up sending him to live with his paternal grandparents, so his father's parents. And, you know, I'm pretty sure Ed Jr. regrets that nowadays, but Kemper was, like, you know, pissed off. Like, he left his mom because he didn't like the way his mom was treating him. He probably felt abandoned by his dad with the fact that his dad was like, yeah, I'm going to send you off to live with your grandparents. And, you know, Kemper said later that he felt like his grandfather was senile and his grandmother berated and belittled him. And he just felt living with his grandparents was really abusive. So by the time he was 15, on August 27th, 1964, after he got into a heated argument with his grandmother in the kitchen, Kemper went to his room and got a rifle that was given to him as a gift by his grandfather, went back in the kitchen, and then shot his grandmother dead. He waited for his grandfather to come back from the store, and when his grandfather walks in, he shoots him too. After he kills his grandparents, he calls his mom and he asks her, "What should I do?" She tells him, "Call the cops." So that's exactly what he did. He called the cops and he told them what happened and he waited for them to show up and arrest him. Now, I want to point out that the rifle that he used to kill his grandparents was a rifle that his grandfather gave him that was taken away from him because he was going out and killing small animals when he wasn't supposed to. And they no longer trusted in him to have the gun because he was doing things he wasn't supposed to. And then he ended up getting the gun back, thus leading him to going in his room, grabbing the rifle and killing his grandparents. When they asked him, when the police came and asked him, like, why did you do it? He was like, he just wanted to see what it would be like to kill his grandma. And then he later testified that he killed his grandfather so that his grandfather wouldn't find out and be mad at him for what he had done. Now, some psychologists believe that the killing of both of his grandparents was like his way of killing both of his parents because of the rejection that he felt from them. And because of this, he was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia and he was sent to Atascadero State Hospital. California got some strange names, okay? Y'all be naming some strange things that I can't say. But it's a maximum security facility in San Luis Obispo County that houses convicts with mental illness. So he stayed there for about 6 years. But while he was incarcerated there, they did an initial IQ testing on him and he scored 136. He, again, was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia. And then later they were like, no, he just has a personality trait disorder. And he has like this like passive aggressive way of like making friends and, you know, whatever. And he used that passive aggressive style to befriend a lot of the psychologists in the facility to the point where like he became their assistant, which is how he got access to other inmate records. And he was allowed to administer psychiatric tests on other inmates. Like, they taught him how to do this. They showed, like, they were allowing him to do this. And this is how he was able to convince the hospital that he was good and, like, mentally sane and that he should go home. And, like, that he should even be released under his mother's care. Now, doctors in the hospital said that is not a good idea. That is not a good look. He is still a threat and a danger to society. Do not send him home. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Leave his ass here. But for some strange, you know, reason, the maximum security facility said, nah, he good. He can go home. He can go home under the care of his mama. Doctors were like, bro, his mom is part of the problem and the reason his psyche is fucked up. Do not send him home, especially back to that trick. What did they do? They sent his ass home. So after 6 years, on December 18th, 1969, at 21 years old, he was released. And for the next about 3 years, he would prove that his rehabilitation worked and that he was rehabilitated and he was good. November 29th, 1972, his juvenile record was expunged. He went to community college as part of his parole. He wanted to be a state trooper, but he ended up being rejected from being a state trooper because he's too big. He stands at about 6'9", somewhere between 275, 300 pounds. He's a big dude, okay? They say, I'm sorry, big fella, but you too big. But he was able to maintain a positive relationship with the police department. And this is where he would earn his nickname, Big Ed. A lot of the cops called him Big Ed. He worked in a bar. They were like, hey, are you cool? Blah, 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 blah. And he got this nickname because of his size. So throughout his 20s, he worked a bunch of, you know, little menial jobs. He landed a job with the state of California's Division of Highway, which is now known as the California Department of Transportation. And during all of this, his relationship with his mother was getting worse. And because of that, he decided he was going to save up money and get his own place in Alameda, California. But he still felt trapped because his mom would just like pop up on him, or she would call him, or if she hit financial difficulties, it was like his job to go back and help her and help her get back on his feet and all this stuff. But around this time, he also got into a very severe motorcycle accident that damaged his arm. He ended up getting a settlement from that accident for $15,000, which in 2021, you know, so the last couple of years, because it was hard to figure out what that would be in 2023, so don't ask me. But in 2021, that equaled to $91,000, a little over $91,000. And with this money, he was able to get a 1969 Ford Galaxy, and this is where he started picking up hitchhikers. Now, initially, he was just being a nice guy. He was just helping women, picking them up, taking them from one place to the next, and he would continue on about his day. But then he started keeping a kill kit in his car. His kill kit had plastic bags, knives, blankets, and handcuffs. And while he was doing this, he started to get these homicidal sexual urges. And in May of 1972, he decided to act on them. So between May of 1972 and April of 1973, almost a year, Kemper kills 8 women. So this is really where all the trigger warnings kick in. Again, all the trigger warnings kick in at this point. We have shooting, smuggling, stabbing, strangling, defiling, of course, decapitation, irrematio. So yeah, it's a lot. He killed 5 college students, 1 high school student, his mom, and his mom's best friend. So we're going to go ahead and divulge into that a little bit. So his first 2 victims, because his first killing was 2 victims, were Mary Ann Pesci and Anita Lucchesa. He picked them up on May 7th, 1972, while he was driving back from Berkeley. He saw that they were hitchhiking. They told him that they were leaving Fresno State University and they needed to get to Stanford University. And he was like, yeah, I can take you. And they were like, cool. So after about an hour, he reaches this secluded wooded area. And this was an area he was used to being in because of the job that he worked. So he kind of knew like the back roads and stuff. And he was able to go in there without the women noticing at first. But once he got there, he handcuffed Marianne and he put Anita in the trunk. He strangled and stabbed both of the women. And then after that, he put both of their bodies in the trunk and he went back to his apartment. That same night, he got stopped by a police officer for having a broken taillight, but they didn't see the bodies in the trunk. So they were like, you know, get your taillight fixed, whatever. But they sent him home. His roommate wasn't home. So he ended up bringing the bodies of both women inside the apartment where he took photos of them. He had sex with their bodies. He dismembered their bodies. He put them in bags. He disposed of their bodies near Lomoa Patera Mountain. But before he got rid of their heads in the ravine, he had irrematio with both of them, which is basically he stuck his penis in their mouths. They're decapitated, big fella. What the fuck are we doing? So that is what he did with the first 2 victims. August of 1972, Marianne's skull was found in the Lomoa Patera Mountains. There is an extensive search, but no other remains have ever been found of either Marianne or Anita. Now, mind you, their families called the police to be like, hey, our daughters are missing. Like, we can't find them. And the police were like, this is a typical runaway. Yeah, they're fine, whatever. Like, they did the whole, like, the typical thing, which, you know, cops got to do better. So his next victim was 15-year-old Akuku. I always say her name wrong. I'm so sorry, sweetheart. She had decided to hitchhike because she missed her bus to dance school. And he was like, hey, I can take you. And she was like, cool. He started to deviate from the route and she immediately noticed and she knew something was wrong. She started to freak out. Ed took out his gun and said that he was going to use it on himself and not her if she didn't calm down and if she started signaling for police. So she calmed down. you know, she like relaxed because she didn't want to be harmed. He said he wasn't going to hurt her or whatever. And then he drove them into the mountains, into this secluded area. He taped her mouth shut and he tried to suffocate her initially by putting his thumb and his index finger into her nostrils. She fought him. She ended up losing consciousness, but she woke back up. And then he suffocated her again. And this time he made sure that like she wasn't breathing. He made sure she was dead. He finally took her body and put it in the trunk. And then he left the scene. He later went for drinks before going to his mother's house, because at this point he was living with his mom again. And later that night, when he finally got home, he took the body out of the trunk and proceeded to do the same thing to Eku that he did to Mary Ann and Anita. All of the same things. I'm not going to rehash all of that. But yeah, so he did all that. He disposed of her body the same way. Only very few of her remains were ever found. Her family, like the others, tried to put in a missing persons report, but again, they never got a response. They never got any help. And, you know, they were like, what the fuck? After about 4 months, when the victims of Kempers started to show up and people were starting to find their body parts, now the public is like, what the fuck? Now the public is starting to be like, yo, something's not right. Stop hitchhiking. Now the public is like a lot more aware of what's going on. But again, we're in January by this point. And in January of 1973, Kemper went out and bought a 22 caliber pistol, even though he was forbidden to have a gun because of his prior crimes. Because he killed his grandparents, he was not allowed to have a gun, but he was still able to purchase one. And we don't find a problem with that even now in 2023, but okay. Now, he was worried that police might be onto him for having a gun. But that same day, he decided to step up his hunting. And later that night, on January 8th, 1973, Cindy Schall was walking and he picked her up and he drove her towards the hills near Watsonville. He forced her into a trunk and he shot her with a new gun. The bullet lodged in her skull. Like, he didn't try and strangle her or nothing. He just shot her dead. Now, Kemper had recently moved back in with his mom, like into a new apartment with his mom. And he would bring Cindy's body into his bedroom. And when his mom left for work the next morning, he had sex with her body. He dissected and dismembered her in the bathtub. You know, he made sure to very meticulously clean the bathroom, make sure all the evidence was removed. He removed the bullet from her head. He took parts of her body and threw them off a cliff where they would end up in an ocean. Now, they were later found when they washed up on shore, and then he buried her head in his mother's backyard. Very specific, you know what I'm saying? Like, he knew what he was doing. He was very aware of, you know, what he was doing. So, February 5th, 1973... this is kind of where everything starts to blow up and like really get intense with him. So February 5th, 1973, Kemper and his mom got into a minor blow up, which led to him like storming out of their apartment. He was so mad and so pissed off that he decided that he was going to go out and pick up another girl. And the first girl he picks up is Rosalinda Thorpe. And he like starts a conversation with her and then he picks up Alice Liu. Like, he makes it so casual or whatever. Now, both women had hesitation about getting into the car initially. He said like he had to kind of like convince them to get in the car. But the main reason why they ended up getting in the car is because he had a UC Santa Cruz sticker prominently displayed on his car. And then they drove around for a little bit. You know, he pointed out the sights to Rosalind, and then as he's like pointing out the sights and driving around, he pulls out his 22 caliber pistol, shoots her point blank in the head, and then he turns around and he shoots Alice multiple times in the back seat. And then he realizes Rosalind isn't dead. So he turns, he shoots her again at point blank range. And then once he knew she was dead, he drove them to a nearby cul-de-sac. He quickly transferred their bodies from inside the car to the trunk and he brought the bodies home. He had sex with Alice's body. He decapitated both the women. He removed the bullets that were lodged, essentially taking away any evidence. He further dismembered their bodies and then discarded them on the road. Their remains were later discovered by hikers near Highway 1 in San Tomeo County. Now, during all of this, there were two other serial killers out in the same area, John Lynn Lindley Frazier and Herbert Mullins. And this is why Santa Cruz at this time gets the nickname murder capital of the world, just because at this time there were three serial killers going at one time and nobody could figure out who the fuck was doing what. But this all culminates and blows up in April, about a month later. So after the double homicides, again, Kemper's living with his mom and everything just kind of blows up, and she doesn't realize that she's going to be the next victim. She's not even aware of like what's going on and what her son's doing. She damn sure isn't aware that she's about to be the next victim. But Easter weekend, all the tension between him and his mom has finally come to like a max. He's ready to get rid of her. He's done with her shit. He's done with arguing. He's done with the relationship. And about 5:15 a.m., while his mother slept peacefully, not aware of what the fuck was going on or what he was about to do, he got a hammer from the kitchen, went into her room, struck her in the head one time, very hard, and then he slashed her throat. He killed her. He beheaded her. He removed her larynx. He tried to put her larynx down the garbage disposal, but then the garbage disposal like spit it back out because like it was just too tough for it to break down, and he found it funny. And then he cleaned up a little bit, and then he dismembered his body and he left the house. Now, he was worried about what he was supposed to do next. He figured that if anyone found her, that they would immediately connect him to it, so he made a plan. He calls his mother friend Sarah and invites her to dinner with him and his mom, but she didn't answer the phone at first. Eventually, he does get in contact with her, and she's like, yeah, I'll come over. I'll come have dinner with you guys. And so she gets to the house, and as soon as she walks in, he strangles Sarah by hand and then later turns around and grabs a scarf that he had got after he had killed Aiko, and he strangles her with that. He takes off all of her clothes and has sex with her dead body. Now, soon after all of that, he leaves the apartment. He took Sarah's car at first and then figured that would probably be too suspicious for him to have her car. So he dropped it at a gas station saying that, hey, I need you guys to like repair it. And then he rented a car, drove for 18 hours, only stopping for gas, soda, and no dose. And then he gets to Colorado, and then he gets pulled over for speeding, but he kept it cool. You know what I'm saying? He kept it cute. And the cops were like, oh, okay, yeah, go ahead, you know, just slow down. And he's like, all right. And he gets settled in Colorado, where he calls the Santa Cruz Police Department, where he knew a lot of the officers. And this is where he begins his confession. We're going to take a break real quick, because that was a lot. We're going to take a quick break, and we will be back. So, yeah. Hey, y'all, and welcome back to another episode of True Crime Boulevard. I'm your host, Bree, and this week we're going to be talking about Edmund Kemper. Okay, so y'all, I know it's been a while, but I'm back now. Ooh, words. I'm back, and I'm going to try and be a little more consistent this year, making sure I get these episodes out. So yeah, I'm so sorry that I've been gone. I'm also working on a new podcast, so, you know, keep your eyes out for that. So with all that information out of the way, let's go ahead and jump into this. So trigger warning. This whole episode is a trigger warning. I think I put some extra trigger warnings in here, but like, just know that the whole episode, from start to finish, the whole episode is a trigger warning. So we're going to be talking about animal abuse, torture, shooting, stabbing, strangulation, decapitation, defiling a corpse, dismemberment, irrematio, all kinds of things. Okay, guys. So yeah, it's just all the things in here. If any of these things are too much for you right now, please take care of yourself and your mental health. And I hope you'll be able to join us in a future episode. So in my usual fashion, all of this good information will be in the show notes down below. Any websites that I used, any podcasts that I listened to, any videos that I watched, because I did watch a lot of like documentaries about this. I also listened to a lot of podcast episodes. So all that information will be in the show notes for you guys. So if you would like to, you know, listen to those or read any of that for yourself, it'll be there. So yeah, let's go ahead and get this thing started. So we're going to talk about his early life a little bit, where he came from. So he was born Edmund Emil Kemper III. He was born December 18th, 1948 in Burbank, California, to Clarnell Stage and Edmund Emil Kemper Jr. He was the only boy of his parents' three children. His parents divorced in 1957. His father would go on to move and get married again and have a stepchild, and they lived in California. Kemper would go on to move in with his mom and his two sisters, and they would move to Montana. But his relationship with his mom would, you know, continue to deteriorate. He had a lot of issues with his mom, he said, because she drank a lot, and this caused a lot of problems with their relationship. And he said that the issues between him and his mom is why he would go on to do what he later did. He said his mom would make fun of him, call him names, and she became very violent towards him. She would make him sleep in a locked basement because she was fearful that he would like molest his sisters or do something to them if he were to sleep upstairs with the rest of the family. Which, I mean, hindsight being 2020, was she wrong? I don't know. Possibly. Her actions might have, you know, assisted in his madness. Who knows? It's also believed that his mother dealt with borderline personality disorder, but Kemper also had a pretty dark side himself. He would dream about killing his mother. He would cut off the heads of his sister's dolls. He liked to play this game called Gas Chamber, where he would have his sisters blindfold him, lead him to a chair, and then once he was in the chair, he would pretend that he was in agony until he quote-unquote died. So that was like a game they would play when he was 10 years old. First trigger warning. He buried the family cat alive, and then he unburied it, dismembered the cat, and then put the cat's head on a stake. He did this at 10. At 13, he slaughtered the family cat, the second family cat. He slaughtered it, and he said he took a lot of pleasure. Like, he enjoyed that a lot because he lied about it. Like, he lied about doing it. He's like, no, I didn't do anything. What are you talking about? And he knew how much his sister loved that cat, and he took great pleasure out of like causing everybody else pain and like lying about it. Now, Kemper managed to keep a pretty good relationship with his father, but the divorce between his parents strained his relationship with his dad a little bit, and it was really, really hard on him on Kemper himself. Like, he took it especially hard. And then for him, the relationship between him and his mom was like complete hell. And the fact that he was living with his mom, he was like, what the fuck? His father said at one point, living with Clarnell, his mom, was like living a suicide mission in war times, and the atomic bomb testings were nothing compared to living with her. Like, he was like, it was actual hell. So by the time Kemper was 14, he ran away from his mom. He ran to Van Nuys, California, where he stayed with his dad. But when he got there, he learned that his dad had gotten remarried and they had a stepson, which made him very unhappy. So he stayed with his dad for a little bit. But after a while, his dad ended up sending him to live with his paternal grandparents, so his father's parents. And, you know, I'm pretty sure Ed Jr. regrets that nowadays, but Kemper was like, you know, pissed off. Like, he left his mom because he didn't like the way his mom was treating him. He probably felt abandoned by his dad with the fact that his dad was like, yeah, I'm gonna send you off to live with your grandparents. And, you know, Kemper said later that he felt like his grandfather was senile and his grandmother berated and belittled him, and he just felt living with his grandparents was really abusive. So by the time he was 15, on August 27th, 1964, after he got into a heated argument with his grandmother in the kitchen, Kemper went to his room and got a rifle that was given to him as a gift by his grandfather, went back in the kitchen, and then shot his grandmother dead. He waited for his grandfather to come back from the store, and when his grandfather walks in, he shoots him too. After he kills his grandparents, he calls his mom and he asks her, what should I do? She tells him, call the cops. So that's exactly what he did. He called the cops and he told them what happened, and he waited for them to show up and arrest him. Now, I want to point out that the rifle that he used to kill his grandparents was a rifle that his grandfather gave him that was taken away from him because he was going out and killing small animals when he wasn't supposed to. And they no longer trusted in him to have the gun because he was doing things he wasn't supposed to. Then he ended up getting the gun back, thus leading him to going in his room, grabbing the rifle, and killing his grandparents. When the police came and asked him, like, why did you do it? He was like, he just wanted to see what it would be like to kill his grandma. And then he later testified that he killed his grandfather so that his grandfather wouldn't find out and be mad at him for what he had done. Now, some psychologists believe that the killing of both of his grandparents was like his way of killing both of his parents because of the rejection that he felt from them. And because of this, he was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia, and he was sent to Atascadero State Hospital. California got some strange names, okay? Y'all be naming some strange things that I can't say. But it's a maximum security facility in San Luis Obispo County that houses convicts with mental illness. So he stayed there for about 6 years. But while he was incarcerated there, they did an initial IQ testing on him, and he scored 136. He, again, was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia. And then later, they were like, no, he just has a personality trait disorder, and he has, like, this, like, aggressive way of, like, making friends and, you know, whatever. And he used that passive-aggressive style to befriend a lot of the psychologists in the facility, to the point where, like, he became their assistant, which is how he got access to other inmate records, and he was allowed to administer psychiatric tests on other inmates. Like, they taught him how to do this. They showed, like, they were allowing him to do this. And this is how he was able to convince the hospital that he was good and, like, mentally sane, and that he should go home, and, like, that he should even be released under his mother's care. Now, doctors in the hospital said that is not a good idea. That is not a good look. He is still a threat and a danger to society. Do not send him home. Do not send him home. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Leave his ass here. But for some strange, you know, reason, the maximum security facility said, nah, he good. He can go home. He can go home under the care of his mama. Doctors were like, bro, his mom is part of the problem and the reason his psyche is fucked up. Do not send him home, especially back to that trick. What did they do? They sent his ass home. So after 6 years, on December 18th, 1969, at 21 years old, he was released. And for the next about 3 years, he would prove that his rehabilitation worked and that he was rehabilitated and he was good. November 29th, 1972, his juvenile record was expunged. He went to community college as part of his parole. He wanted to be a state trooper, but he ended up being rejected from being a state trooper because he's too big. He stands at about 6'9", somewhere between 275, 300 pounds. He's a big dude, okay? They say, I'm sorry, big fella, but you're too big. But he was able to maintain a positive relationship with the police department. And this is where he would earn his nickname, Big Ed. A lot of the cops called him Big Ed. He worked in a bar. They were like, hey, are you cool? Blah, 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 blah. And he got this nickname because of his size. So throughout his 20s, he worked a bunch of, you know, little menial jobs. He landed a job with the state of California's Division of Highway, which is now known as the California Department of Transportation. And during all of this, his relationship with his mother was getting worse. And because of that, he decided he was going to save up money and get his own place in Alameda, California. But he still felt trapped because his mom would just, like, pop up on him, or she would call him, or if she hit financial difficulties, it was, like, his job to go back and help her and help her get back on his feet and all this stuff. But around this time, he also got into a very severe motorcycle accident that damaged his arm. He ended up getting a settlement from that accident for $15,000, which in 2021... you know, so the last couple of years, because it was hard to figure out what that would be in 2023, so don't ask me. But in 2021, that equaled to $91,000, a little over $91,000. And with this money, he was able to get a 1969 Ford Galaxy, and this is where he started picking up hitchhikers. Now, initially, he was just being a nice guy. He was just helping women, picking them up, taking them from one place to the next, and he would continue on about his day. But then he started keeping a kill kit in his car. His kill kit had plastic bags, knives, blankets, and handcuffs. And while he was doing this, he started to get these homicidal sexual urges. And in May of 1972, he decided to act on them. So between May of 1972 and April of 1973, almost a year, Kemper kills 8 women. So this is really where all the trigger warnings kick in. Again, all the trigger warnings kick in at this point. We have shooting, smuggling, stabbing, strangling, defiling, of course, decapitation, irrematio. So yeah, it's a lot. He killed 5 college students, 1 high school student, his mom, and his mom's best friend. So we're going to go ahead and divulge into that a little bit. So his first two victims, because his first killing was two victims, were Mary Ann Pesci and Anita Lucchesa. He picked them up on May 7th, 1972, while he was driving back from Berkeley. He saw that they were hitchhiking. They told him that they were leaving Fresno State University and they needed to get to Stanford University. And he was like, yeah, I can take you. And they were like, cool. So after about an hour, he reaches this secluded wooded area. And this was an area he was used to being in because of the job that he worked. So he kind of knew like the back roads and stuff. And he was able to go in there without the women noticing at first. But once he got there, he handcuffed Marianne and he put Anita in the trunk. He strangled and stabbed both of the women. And then after that, he put both of their bodies in the trunk and he went back to his apartment. That same night, he got stopped by a police officer for having a broken taillight, but they didn't see the bodies in the trunk. So they were like, you know, get your taillight fixed, whatever. But they sent him home. His roommate wasn't home. So he ended up bringing the bodies of both women inside the apartment where he took photos of them. He had sex with their bodies. He dismembered their bodies. He put them in bags. He disposed of their bodies near Lomoa Patera Mountain. But before he got rid of their heads in the ravine, he had irrematio with both of them, which is basically he stuck his penis in their mouths. They're decapitated, big fella. What the fuck are we doing? So that is what he did with the first two victims. August of 1972, Marianne's skull was found in the Lomoa Patera Mountains. There is an extensive search, but no other remains have ever been found of either Marianne or Anita. Now, mind you, their families called the police to be like, hey, our daughters are missing. Like, we can't find them. And the police were like, this is a typical runaway. Yeah, they're fine. Whatever. Like, they did the typical thing, which, you know, cops got to do better. So his next victim was 15-year-old Akuku. I always say her name wrong. I'm so sorry, sweetheart. She had decided to hitchhike because she missed her bus to dance school. And he was like, hey, I can take you. And she was like, cool. He started to deviate from the route and she immediately noticed and she knew something was wrong. She started to freak out. Ed took out his gun and said that he was going to use it on himself and not her if she didn't calm down and if she started signaling for police. So she calmed down, you know, she like relaxed because she didn't want to be harmed. He said he wasn't going to hurt her or whatever. And then he drove them into the mountains, into this secluded area. He taped her mouth shut and he tried to suffocate her initially by putting his thumb and his index finger into her nostrils. She fought him. She ended up losing consciousness, but she woke back up and then he suffocated her again. And this time he made sure that like she wasn't breathing. He made sure she was dead. He finally took her body and put it in the trunk and then he left the scene. He later went for drinks before going to his mother's house because at this point he was living with his mom again. And later that night, when he finally got home, he took the body out of the trunk and proceeded to do the same things to Aku that he did to Mary Ann and Anita. All of the same things. I'm not going to rehash all of that. But yeah, so he did all that. He disposed of her body the same way. Only very few of her remains were ever found. Her family, like the others, tried to put in a missing persons report. But again, they never got a response. They never got any help. And... you know, they were like, what the fuck? After about 4 months, when the victims of Kemper started to show up and people were starting to find their body parts, now the public is like, what the fuck? Now the public is starting to be like, yo, something's not right. Stop hitchhiking. Now the public is like a lot more aware of what's going on. But again, we're in January by this point. In January of 1973, Kemper went out and bought a .22 caliber pistol, even though he was forbidden to have a gun because of his prior crimes. Because he killed his grandparents, he was not allowed to have a gun, but he was still able to purchase one. And we don't find a problem with that even now in 2023, but okay. Now, he was worried that police might be onto him for having a gun. But that same day, he decided to step up his hunting. And later that night, on January 8th, 1973, Cindy Schall was walking and he picked her up and he drove her towards the hills near Watsonville. He forced her into a trunk and he shot her with a new gun. The bullet lodged in her skull. Like, he didn't try and strangle her or nothing. He just shot her dead. Now, Kemper had recently moved back in with his mom, like into a new apartment with his mom. And he would bring Cindy's body into his bedroom. And when his mom left for work the next morning, he had sex with her body. He dissected and dismembered her in the bathtub. You know, he made sure to very meticulously clean the bathroom, make sure all the evidence was removed. He removed the bullet from her head. He took parts of her body and threw them off a cliff where they would end up in an ocean. Now, they were later found when they washed up on shore. And then he buried her head in his mother's backyard. Very specific, you know what I'm saying? Like, he knew what he was doing. He was very aware of, you know, what he was doing. So, February 5th, 1973. This is kind of where everything starts to blow up and, like, really get intense with him. So February 5th, 1973, Kemper and his mom got into a minor blow up, which led to him like storming out of their apartment. He was so mad and so pissed off that he decided that he was going to go out and pick up another girl. And the first girl he picks up is Rosalinda Thorpe. And he like starts a conversation with her, and then he picks up Alice Liu. Like, he makes it so casual or whatever. Now, both women had hesitation about getting into the car initially. He said like he had to kind of like convince them to get in the car. But the main reason why they ended up getting in the car is because he had a UC Santa Cruz sticker prominently displayed on his car. And then they drove around for a little bit. You know, he pointed out the sights to Rosalind. And then as he's like pointing out the sights and driving around, he pulls out his 22 caliber pistol, shoots her point blank in the head. And then he turns around and he shoots Alice multiple times in the back seat. And then he realizes Rosalind isn't dead. So he turns, he shoots her again at point blank range. And then once he knew she was dead, he drove them to a nearby cul-de-sac. He quickly transferred their bodies from inside the car to the trunk, and he brought the bodies home. He had sex with Alice's body. He decapitated both the women. He removed the bullets that were lodged, essentially taking away any evidence. He further dismembered their bodies and then discarded them on the road. Their remains were later discovered by hikers near Highway 1 in San Tomeo County. Now, during all of this, there were two other serial killers out in the same area, Linley Frazier and Herbert Mullins. And this is why Santa Cruz at this time gets the nickname Murder Capital of the World, just because at this time there were three serial killers going at one time and nobody could figure out who the fuck was doing what. But this all culminates and blows up in April, about a month later. So after the double homicides, again, Kemper's living with his mom and everything just kind of blows up, and she doesn't realize that she's going to be the next victim. She's not even aware of like what's going on and what her son's doing. She damn sure isn't aware that she's about to be the next victim. But Easter weekend, all the tension between him and his mom has finally come to like a max. He's ready to get rid of her. He's done with her shit. He's done with arguing. He's done with the relationship. And about 5:15 a.m., while his mother slept peacefully, not aware of what the fuck was going on or what he was about to do, he got a hammer from the kitchen, went into her room, struck her in the head one time, very hard, and then he slashed her throat. He killed her. He beheaded her. He removed her larynx. He tried to put her larynx down the garbage disposal, but then the garbage disposal like spit it back out because like it was just too tough for it to break down, and he found it funny. And then he cleaned up a little bit, and then he dismembered his body and he left the house. Now, he was worried about what he was supposed to do next. He figured that if anyone found her, that they would immediately connect him to it, so he made a plan. He calls his mother friend Sarah and invites her to dinner with him and his mom, but she didn't answer the phone at first. Eventually he does get in contact with her and she's like, yeah, I'll come over. I'll come have dinner with you guys. And so she gets to the house, and as soon as she walks in, he strangles Sarah by hand and then later turns around and grabs a scarf that he had got after he had killed Aiko, and he strangles her with that. He takes off all of her clothes and has sex with her dead body. Now, soon after all of that, he leaves the apartment. He took Sarah's car at first and then figured that would probably be too suspicious for him to have her car. So he dropped it at a gas station saying that, hey, I need you guys to like repair it. And then he rented a car, drove for 18 hours, only stopping for gas, soda, and no dose. And then once he gets to Colorado, and then he gets to Colorado, I'm sorry. He gets to Colorado, and then he gets pulled over for speeding, but he kept it cool. You know what I'm saying? He kept it cute. And the cops were like, oh, okay, yeah, go ahead, you know, just slow down. And he's like, all right. And he gets settled in Colorado, where he calls the Santa Cruz Police Department, where he knew a lot of the officers. And this is where he begins his confession. We're going to take a break real quick because that was a lot. We're going to take a quick break and we will be back. So, yeah.